If you lived in Danville in 1910, your congressman was a fellow townsman who was also Speaker of the House. Joe Cannon was a foul-mouthed but likable Republican who fostered a public image of being a plain-spoken rube. He was, in fact, a very smart guy and one of the most powerful House speakers in U.S. history. Cannon had come up through the House Rules Committee, and he used those rules to block President Teddy Roosevelt's progressive agenda whenever he could. But in 1910, Cannon would face a rebellion from his party's growing progressive wing that would be the beginning of the end of his rule in Congress. I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, we'll talk about Danville Congressman Joseph Gurney Cannon, the issues of his day that he cared about, and how he helped shape American history. My guests are local historian Timothy Smith and U.S. House historian Matt Wasniewski, coming up after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Back in January, writer Kenneth Ackerman wrote a piece in the Huffington Post comparing House Speaker John Boehner's conflicts with Tea Party Republicans to the progressive insurgency that Speaker Joe Cannon faced back in 1910. That's only one article on a website, but it's more attention than Uncle Joe usually gets these days. There have been books written about Joseph Cannon's rule as House Speaker, but as I found out in preparing for this show, they're mostly long out of print. And yet, Joseph Cannon was once one of the most powerful men in Washington, who was happy to play up the concept that he was just a hayseed from the Wabash Valley. Today on Focus, we'll look back at the career of Joe Cannon, the causes that he fought for and fought against, and the long-lasting impact he had on Washington politics. Timothy Smith is a retired attorney and longtime Danville resident who's working on a biography of longtime Danville resident Joseph Cannon. And Matt Wasniewski is historian for the House of Representatives. Timothy and Matt, welcome to Focus.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And if you have any questions for our guests about Joe Cannon and his times, you can call us at 333-9455 or toll free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. But you know, I'm thinking a lot of folks are wondering as we talk here, like, who was Joe Cannon? And I don't know where to start in this, but maybe us, if we want to go with him, his role as House Speaker, maybe I should go over to you, Matt. What sort of House Speaker was Joe Cannon, and why was he important?
Then first of all, thanks for having me on, Jim. Joe Cannon was, when you think about speakers, the most colorful. And certainly, he served at a time when the speakership was at the zenith of its powers. And so he was a very influential speaker. He served for four terms, from 1903 to 1911, and for a very long time was the longest-serving Republican speaker in the House. Actually, Dennis Hastert surpassed him late in his term as speaker. But Cannon was an extremely influential individual in national politics, not just in the running of the House, he took over from a set of rules that had empowered the Speaker in the 1890s, and he used those in a way that was a little bit different from Thomas Brackett Reed, who had reformed the rules in the 1890s, to actually open up the flow of legislation and to get bills moving. Cannon used those same powers as often as not to kind of slow down the legislative process, because he was someone who was not quite in sympathy with the progressive reform agenda of Republican members in the House and also the Theodore Roosevelt White House.
Now, the Joe Cannon who became House Speaker at the beginning of the 20th century was a guy who lived in East Central Illinois, not native to there, but he lived, but that's where he ended up, first in Tuscola and then in Danville. And Tim Smith, he was already He already had a pretty long political career before he became Speaker.
Well, he had a small political career here in Illinois because he served as district attorney, what we now call state's attorney, in the new county of Douglas, which was cut out of Coles County, and he was elected in 1861. By serving as district attorney for the district, he, during the Civil War from 61 to 68, rode the circuit as it existed for that district, and in the process became acquainted with the local politicians and the people in those counties. And I suspect that that acquaintance with those politicians and that activities laid the groundwork for his first run for Congress in 1870, which he lost.
Okay. How many tries did it take for him to get elected?
His second try in 1872, assuming office, I believe, in 1873, was his first successful try for Congress. But he had served two terms as the prosecuting attorney in East Central Illinois prior to that.
Okay. And Matt, he spent several years in Congress. He came up through the Rules Committee, and from what I gathered about him, that was something that was important to the way that he held on to power.
Yeah, he's a transitional figure in a lot of ways, and he in a way embodies a lot of the change that was going on in the House at the time. It was being institutionalized, professionalized. Cannon served for 28 years before he became Speaker of the House, and that was unusual because in the 19th century, most members served, two or three terms in the House and then went back to state politics or went back to local business. And Cannon stayed on, and that really heralded what was going to happen in the early 20th century as more and more members made careers of staying in Washington, spending 20, 30, in some cases 40 years. And so he had a lot of time in the trenches. He was a lieutenant for Thomas Brackett Reed, the great speaker from Maine, who reformed the rules of the House in the early 1890s and really consolidated power in the speakership. He was Appropriations Committee chairman under Reed. He was on the Rules Committee under Reed. And so he was part and parcel of a lot of the institutional change that was going on.
You know, when I look at the briefest descriptions of where Cannon stood politically, I get the idea that he was someone who supported business interests, someone who came out of the so-called Gilded Age, who ran up against progressive reformers in the Republican Party. He might have been someone who supported the trusts and the laws that made the trusts viable. Is that close to what Joe Cannon was?
Yeah, he was generally pro-business. He was, in a way, a bit of a stand-patter.
That's the phrase he liked to use.
He was famous for the quote, "Everything's all right out west and in Danville. The country don't need no more legislation," and that was a phrase he used during his speakership. He's very much a man of the 19th century. And in a way, not as forward-thinking about progressive reforms as the country became, a mass democracy and all the changes that were taking place with industrialism. And he certainly tended to come down on the side of business.
And that makes me think, Tim, looking at Joe Cannon coming up in East Central Illinois, Would East Central Illinois back then have essentially been an area that's what they wanted in a politician, or was it more of a split?
Very much so, because Central Illinois at that time was a really booming economy. Chicago was still a very small town. The north end of the state was not as economically developed as Central Illinois and Southern Illinois. And the stand patter in everything is fine in business back in Danville raises an interesting point for Joe's career, and that is the reliance upon his brother, William or Bill, to provide the income to him to remain in Congress. Joe had a very successful businessman for a brother, And the businessmen allowed Joe to remain a partner in his business affairs in Danville. So essentially, Bill ran the businesses very successfully. He was a banker and shared the profits with Joe so that Joe could continue his political career. That might be one of the reasons why Joe could stay in Congress so long, because he had the financial support directly and indirectly of his brother Bill back in Danville.
Matt, would that be legally possible today, that sort of arrangement?
Certainly a family member could include you in the family business. There's a lot more reporting and transparency that has to happen now.
Maybe more people would have known about it. But you mentioned, Tim, you mentioned business interests supporting Joe Cannon. There are also a lot of farmers in East Central Illinois. And what I gathered in reading about him is one of the big conflicts was between farmers and business interests in such areas as, for instance, the railroads. So did Joe Cannon have his enemies back home?
Very much so. And you could call them Democrats. Just about any Democrat was an enemy of Joe Cannon.
How strong were the Democrats in East Central Illinois?
They were fairly strong, particularly during the Civil War, where there was a lot of Democratic sympathy for the South.
And I think, as you noted, that Joe Cannon was a district attorney out of Douglas County. That was in the 1860s.
That was correct. But in the 70s and 80s and 90s, because of his family business interests through his brother, he was always in favor of and worked for the business interests. But he also, on the other side, had a very strong belief in the right for a person to have a job and to be paid for that job. And one of the reasons why he had that was because of an incident involving his father in Annapolis, Indiana, when he was growing up, because his father had hired a black man to work on the farm. Under the black laws in Indiana at the time, you had to post a bond to accomplish that. His father did not post the bond. His father was prosecuted under the black laws for doing so. A judgment was entered against him. The sheriff came and took his father's horses as well as some of the farm livestock, and that always rested on Joe's mind, as everybody, no matter what your color, should have the right to work for pay. So you have, in a sense, you have this business interest that he lobbied for and worked for in Congress, but yet you also have this individual experience of a right to work for anybody and everybody to get paid for it.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about Joseph Cannon and his times. Note that Cannon was a Danville congressman. Earlier this month marked the 177th anniversary of his birth. Cannon served as Speaker of the House in the early 20th century, and we're talking about him with local historian Timothy Smith and U.S. House historian Matt Wisniewski. You can call us with your comments and questions at 333-9455. Are toll-free at 1-800-222-9455, or you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number, again, is 333-WILL or 1-800-222-WILL. And I'm wondering, do we have a caller now? So I'm going to go to line 4 for a caller from Belgium, Illinois. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, good morning to you all. Coming from over where Uncle Joe had his home. Matter of fact, I just left the bank that he started. And I still have the little thing on the wall. It was his charter, I guess, was it?
Which bank was that?
It was the Second National Bank, but it's been incorporated into other banks, and now it's called First Midwest Bank.
Okay.
But the building that was there originally was, the location he was originally at was called the Second National Bank of Danville.
And there's a plaque there of some sort?
No, there's a framed letter, framed piece of paper.
Uh-huh.
And there was the charter. But the thing I thought was so interesting about Uncle Joe was a statement he had about politicians. He said, "You should always select the devil you know, not the devil you don't know," which I thought was very telling about all politicians.
Tell me about, And Tim, I want to direct this question to you. Tell me about that sort of attitude towards politics. He was a pretty plain spoken guy, I take it.
Very plain spoken. He always pushed the idea that he was a hayseed, that he had oats in his pockets.
Was he?
Very common, but no, he was a very sharp, very well-read politician. And he played the part because he knew it would work within his district. The bank that our caller is talking about, the old Second National Bank, was actually started by his brother Bill. His brother Bill had started a bank in Tuscola, had been successful at it. Brother Bill moved up to Danville in the early 1870s, started another bank, and that morphed into the Second National Bank in 1881. And once again, Joe was made a silent partner in the banking operation, and his brother would share the profits from the bank. As a matter of fact, when his brother died in 1902, the family business affairs were taken over by Joe's son-in-law, a man by the name of Le Sueur. And when Joe died in 1926, when you look at his estate papers in Vermilion County, one of the pieces of property that he owned is a half interest in the ground that bank was located in downtown Danville.
I wonder who owns it now.
First Midwest Bank, but if the caller has some more interest.
Yeah, the building is still there, but it's been redone many, many times. It does not look like it used to in any way, shape. The front has been rechanged and everything. It's a very modern bank now.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, he's still located at the same location. They still have a bank at that location. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. And I'm just wondering, that is a bank that then survived, I guess, more than one depression, actually, to make it up into the various mergers to what it is today.
Yeah, actually, there were a number of banking crises during the Gilded Age, and Bill managed to navigate those quite nicely. By the way, his brother Bill died because he fell out of a window in that bank. He was adjusting a curtain on the second floor.
Oh, jeez.
And he fell out of the window and suffered the damages of the fall and died a couple of days later as a result of that.
Matt, I wanted to ask you, how did Joe Cannon make it to the speakership? What were the events or the political context of him becoming speaker in the early 20th century?
Yeah, well, he had been a lieutenant for Thomas Brackett Reed, and that was a major climb up the leadership ladder for him. He'd actually challenged Reed in 1888. Briefly for the speakership, and then Reed wisely kind of brought him on board, devil you know type situation, and put him in very prominent positions as chairman of the Appropriations Committee. There was a hiccup in 1890. He lost re-election to Congress, but this was in something of a wave election where there was a backlash against the McKinley Tariff, Republicans were out of favor with voters, but he comes back in the next term, and Republicans actually are swung into the majority in 1894 in another wave election. And from there until 1911, Republicans are in control of the House. And Thomas Brackett Reed serves as Speaker for a couple more terms in the 1890s. Speaker Henderson from Iowa takes over for two terms, viewed by Cannon and his lieutenants is somewhat weak and ineffectual. And Cannon runs for the speakership in 1903 and wins.
And why do his colleagues choose him?
Well, Cannon obviously had worked his way up the leadership ladder. There was no one more senior than Cannon. It's interesting to go back to Cannon's a 19th century man. He was 67 years old when he became Speaker of the House. And no one had been that old and become Speaker of the House. The average person in the 19th century was perhaps in their mid-40s. And so Cannon had been around. He was a known quantity. He was very respected by the membership in general. In a lot of ways, he reminds me of Henry Clay in terms of the rapport and the genuine affection that members had for him on both sides of the aisle. Even people who later deposed him from the speakership recalled him fondly. And that was because, you know, he was a storyteller. He liked to play cards. You know, he shared a lot of experiences with the members, and he was respected for that. And he also looked out for the prerogatives of the House, vis-a-vis the presidency and the Senate. I mean, he was a man of the House and believed that the House played some definite constitutional roles, and he was he would protect those. So widely respected among members.
Tim, I was wondering the likability that that Joe Cannon seemed to engender on both sides of the aisle in the House, was that pretty much a hallmark of his personal style all the way through?
Yes, it was. Although he could, within local party politics, become very aggressive and very, very vengeful in regards to dealing with the Democrats that were in Danville. An illustration to show this occurred in the 1890s when the Cannon family was involved in a dispute with the English family and the Democrats in Danville for control of the city of Danville. What was at stake were the gas, electricity, and streetcar lines and the businesses that that the Cannons owned, and they were in competition with another set. And the mayor of Danville at that time was a man by the name of John Beard. Beard, as a Democrat, was anxious to be appointed postmaster for Danville. Throughout the entire time that he was attempting to get that confirmation, Cannon used every political pull that he had to deny Beard that. And just as soon as Cannon got back into office in 93 and McKinley is elected president, Cannon literally walks into the White House before even McKinley gets his cabinet appointed and gets his man by the name of Jewell, appointed as postmaster for Danville. So, yes, he could get along with the devil, but he was also very partisan, and if he could gain an advantage for a Republican, he would do so and deny it to a Democrat.
And, Matt, I'm wondering, Joe Cannon is apparently a guy who knew how to use the rules. What rules did he have working for him that he was able to use so effectively as Speaker?
By the time he becomes Speaker, the Speaker has really a complete toolkit of rules and powers at his hands, at his disposal. And Cannon was, at that point, not only the presiding officer in the chamber, the Speaker of the House, who could control the flow of legislation on the floor and the flow of debate, he also had final say over where proposed bills would be referred, to which committees they would go to. He, at the same time, had the ability to appoint every member in the House, regardless of their party, to committees. He made all the assignments. And so he could stack committees. He could send bills to committees that he if he didn't support the legislation, he could send it to a committee where he knew it would just die a languishing death. He had a lot of powers. And, of course, he was also at that point, the Speaker served as chairman of the Rules Committee. And the Rules Committee in the House is an extremely powerful panel. I mean, most people off of Capitol Hill rarely hear the Rules Committee. It doesn't mean a lot to them. The Senate has a Rules and Administration Committee, but it's a completely different thing. Their Rules Committee hands out parking spaces and decides where Capitol Art's going to hang on the walls. The House Rules Committee structures every piece of legislation for debate on the House floor, determines how it's going to be debated, how much time is going to be allotted to the bill. And so Cannon had a number of places where he could either promote legislation or check it and send it to a committee graveyard if he wanted.
I am wondering, and perhaps this is more of a question for Tim, when we look at the very powerful House Speaker in Illinois today, Mike Madigan, does he enjoy a similar scope of rules that Joe Cannon had 110 years ago.
He may not have the control through the Rules Committee, but through the power of the party, the Democratic Party.
And he is the chairman of the Illinois Democratic Party.
And other tools within the Illinois House, he probably exercises power comparable to what Joe exercised as Speaker in Washington.
And Matt, the House Speaker today, does today's House Speaker have the same sort of rules at their fingertips that Joe Cannon did?
No. The House Speaker doesn't enjoy the same kind of powers. It's still a very powerful position. It is still the most powerful position on the House side, but nothing like Cannon. And one example is that the Speaker still does not serve on the Rules Committee, although the Speaker appoints majority members to the Rules Committee. And the Rules Committee is set up so that, you know, the majority can work its legislative will. The ratio now of majority members on the Rules Committee to minority is 9-4. And in Cannon's day, it was there were 5 total members, 3 Republicans, 2 Democrats. So, speakers don't have the power that Cannon did. One of the things that's interesting down at National Archives, there's actually a Cannon trunk at the Center for Legislative Archives. And this was a trunk that Cannon and before him, Speaker Henderson, would take back to their district when the House was out of session. And it would be filled with notebooks about every member of the House, facts about their district, their former committee assignments, and then letters from these members beseeching Speaker Cannon to give them an assignment, you know, on the Appropriations Committee, on the Judiciary Committee. Dear Uncle Joe is how a lot of these letters would be addressed, you know, a term of affection.
And Joe Cannon became very powerful from some of the stuff I was reading. It seemed to suggest that he had a power and influence that went beyond the House chamber, especially during his later years as Speaker. Can you talk to that to any degree?
Sure. In his relations with the president, particularly Theodore Roosevelt, whose their terms overlapped, and then at the very end, William Howard Taft, and the Cannon Roosevelt relationship is interesting. You know, Roosevelt takes over after McKinley was assassinated. And he's in office for almost 2 years before Cannon becomes Speaker. And they had become acquainted with each other in the 1890s when Roosevelt would occasionally come testify before Cannon's Appropriations Committee for naval appropriations. Roosevelt was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And Cannon, very early on, had developed a rather unflattering view of Roosevelt as someone who was a spendthrift, and he was not at all in tune with his progressive leanings. He felt that Roosevelt, as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, was never happy no matter how many ships were in the Navy. Cannon was an interesting Appropriations Committee chairman. I mean, his whole approach, at one point he told a reporter, "You think my job is to appropriate money, but my job is to prevent the appropriation of money." So again, that kind of stand-patter, very fiscally conservative mentality towards making federal appropriations. Anticipating problems with Cannon, Roosevelt kind of courts him early in that first term, 1903, and the two have a very cordial relationship. They meet frequently. They exchange warm correspondence. Roosevelt actually throws a banquet for Cannon that later becomes a staple, a banquet in honor of speakers. But Cannon, in the end, didn't really succumb to that to the TR warm treatment. And by the second term, when TR is elected in his own right after 1904, their relationship increasingly becomes confrontational over progressive legislation.
And I read that there was a point where Joe Cannon was was seeking or at least exploring the possibility of running for president himself?
In 1908, he was promoted for that, but you know, it seems to be somewhat half-hearted on his part.
He would have been pretty old for a presidential candidate.
He would have at that point he would have been in his early 70s. I'm not sure how much stock I would put in him actually thinking that he could have won that contest. He was in the House. He was the speakership at that point was very prominent relative to the presidency. I mean, that's something that from our perspective in the early 21st century, you know, people think about legislative initiative and executive leadership. They think about the presidency, but in this era, and it was in transition, people thought about Congress as a leading part of the federal government when it came to initiating legislation, initiating reform. And Cannon certainly realized that his position as Speaker put him in a very prominent place in that discussion with TR.
Well, it's time for a short break. We will be back in a moment with more on Joseph Cannon, the House Speaker from Danville. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus with Tim Smith and Matt Wisniewski talking about Joseph Cannon of Danville, who served as House Speaker in the early 20th century. You can call us with your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. And Tim, you're working on a biography of Joe Cannon, I understand.
Well, I've started working on it. I've always wanted to know how Joe Cannon became Joe Cannon. Pretty much most of the academic studies of Joe concentrate on his years as Speaker and his downfall as Speaker. Very little concentrates on the years of growing up and his time in Tuscola, in his years in Danville when he was congressman prior to his speakership. And I've been looking at that as a possibility and doing research into that to see if there's anything feasible to be done, because there are so few materials on Joe in this time period. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've gone 60-plus years since the last real major biographical effort on Joe.
And that book, I believe that's the book I have in front of me here. It's called Tyrant from Illinois, which gives you some idea of how Joe Cannon was regarded by its detractors. Uncle Joe Cannon's Experiment with Personal Power by Blair Bowles. This is from 1951. Matt, I'm wondering, when we're talking about personal power, what are we talking about here for Joe Cannon?
Personal power in terms of the chamber?
Well, I'm assuming, I don't know if that meant something specifically for Joe Cannon, but that was the subtitle of the 1951 Blair Bowles book about him.
Well, personal power in terms of the operations of the House were centered in that one person. There really were no checks or breaks on Cannon until late in his speakership.
That happened in 1910.
Yeah, it does happen in 1910. The it had been building for a few years as there were more progressive Republicans elected to Congress. Cannon had some pretty good working majorities for speakers, especially if you compare them to the modern speakers. I mean, he had anywhere between 45 and in one instance almost 100-seat majority margins. But increasingly, especially in his last two terms, more of those Republican members were progressives. They were from the Midwest, the Far West. Their constituents either had been hurt by these downturns in the economic cycles in the 1890s, the early 1900s. There were agricultural interests, and they were more in tune with the progressive agenda. And a group of what came to be known as insurgents, led by George Norris of Nebraska and Victor Murdoch of Kansas, began to challenge Cannon's supremacy as Speaker, trying to modify the rules to get him off the Rules Committee.
And what finally happened in 1910?
Well, in 1910, this is at the end of the 61st Congress. At the opening of the Congress, a number of Republicans didn't vote for Cannon as Speaker, but he was reelected comfortably. Champ Clark, who was the Democratic leader, tried to modify the rules to get Cannon off the Rules Committee and to curb his appointment powers to the Rules Committee. And then that failed as well, and Cannon was very harsh in his punishment of the insurgents and Champ Clark. By late in that Congress, George Norris, who had for a very long time been looking for an opening on the floor, managed to get Cannon to recognize him. This was, and this is a little in the weeds, but there had been a debate the day before related to the census, and that debate had started by a member coming to the floor and asking for his bill to be recognized because it was privileged, because the census is mentioned in the Constitution. And Norris watched this happen, and the day after is on the floor and seeks Cannon's recognition and says that he has a privileged question that he'd like to make. And Cannon recognizes him. He's in the chair, and that's when Norris takes his resolution up to the reading clerk, and the clerk reads it. And all of a sudden, everyone realizes, hey, this is a challenge to Cannon's speakership. And what happens is for a day, and the resolution was to essentially strip Cannon of his appointment powers, the Rules Committee, take him off that committee. And for a day, Cannon delays making a ruling on Norris's motion, and they're trying to get regular Republicans, Cannon supporters, back in the chamber because a number of them were out of town. But after about 24 hours of delay, Cannon makes the ruling that he finds Norris's resolution out of order. But the insurgent Republicans, now allying with Democrats, vote to override that Cannon's ruling. And then there's a vote on Norris's resolution, which the whole House approves. And Cannon is stripped of his appointment powers to the Rules Committee and his position on the Rules Committee.
And that, I take it, is sort of the beginning of the end. He's still Speaker for a couple of years, but after that...
He's still Speaker for another year, and he had been anticipating that challenge, and interestingly, that same day, he basically challenged the insurgents and the Democrats to vacate his seat, and realizing that he would get unified Republican support. So he held on to his speakership, but it was greatly diminished after that. He's reelected in 1910 to the House, but that's when Democrats come into the majority.
What does it mean then? What is the change in the laws that get passed in the House or the appropriations made once Cannon's power is diminished?
Well, it two things. It brings in a Democratic majority comes in. 2 years later, we get a progressive president, Woodrow Wilson, and there is for two congressional terms a flurry of progressive legislation that Wilson had envisioned and that had been bubbling up in Congress and that was passed. So you get that part of it. The other part of it is more internal to the institution of the House, and that's that for a brief time, Champ Clark becomes Speaker in 1911, Democrat from Missouri, and he runs the House for much of the 19-teens. And the powers of the speakership are gradually taken apart, and power kind of flows out to individual members. The Democratic caucus, there's an experiment in the caucus kind of making committee assignments and running the floor. But very quickly, within about a decade, what happens is that the power that once was lodged in the speakership flows down to committee chairs. And it's really committee chairs that run the House from the 1920s all the way up until the 1970s, until there are reforms that are instituted to fight what are perceived to be their abuses of power or their lack of legislative initiative. So it has a lot of consequences for the House as it evolved over much of the 20th century.
From what I read, Joe Cannon's power as House Speaker was called, and this was what his critics called it, was Cannonism.
Yes.
I'm looking at his at Joe Cannon's memoirs, the ones written by ghostwritten by his personal secretary,
Dwight Busby.
Yes, that's yep. Right. Solemnly and with bell, book, and candle, Cannonism has been damned by Bryan, damned by La Follette, damned by Cummins, denounced by their satellites, and consigned to perdition by the Metropolitan Press and the country weeklies. I have tried but failed to find the difference between Cannonism and Carlyleism or Reedism or Crispism or Hendersonism or the ism of any other speaker who has presided over the House during the long years I have been a member. It will be the ism of every speaker who succeeds Cannon, who will enforce the rules honestly and impartially, and holds his self-respect to be more precious than mere fleeting popularity. So Joseph Cannon, I gather, if this memoir written, actually published after Joe Cannon's death, is reliable, was certainly not repentant after he lost his power.
No, not at all. Not at all. And you know, you ticked off a bunch of speakers there, Randall, Reed, Carlyle. They all exercised great power as speakers. Those decades were really when the speakership was at its pinnacle. But Cannon did it with such panache on the floor. I mean, he's one of the most quotable speakers. One time a member introduces an amendment on the floor, Cannon recognizes him, and, you know, the bill is debated on the floor, but Cannon's not too terribly supportive, and it goes to a voice vote for whether it's going to pass. And Cannon famously says, well, you know, the ayes make the most noise, but the nays have it. And he just would cut people off. I mean, he was able to get away with it. When the conservationists were pushing him, this is Gifford Pinchot and under TR, and he was not at all in sympathy with Roosevelt's conservation program. And Pinchot came down to see him, and Cannon looked at him and said, basically, not one damn cent for scenery. We're not paying for it. And you know, the debate ended there. So Cannon could be very mercurial. He could be czar-like. And just ran the House with an iron fist. But at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, he was beloved by his colleagues. I mean, I don't want to overstate Democrats being in love with him. They weren't when he ruled against them. And he could be very arbitrary. He could be very vindictive. But there was this sense that Cannon believed in, again, protecting what he thought were the prerogatives of the speakership and the prerogatives of the House. And members, I think, respected that at a level.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions about Danville resident and U.S. House Speaker Joseph Cannon. For Matt Wisniewski, historian for the House of Representatives, and Timothy Smith, local historian who's working on a biography of Joe Cannon. Phone number is 333-9455 or call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Let's take a call on line one, Paul in Champaign County. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Yeah, starting with a bad pun, this all sounds like a canonization here. I've been waiting to hear some of the substance of what's what was at stake, and the only thing I just heard was about the scenery, the idea of conservation of TR. But TR was making a lot of noise about trust busting. I presume Cannon was kind of on the opposite side, probably a real beholden to the railroad interests and all that. And the progressive era, after the collapse of the economy, became quite insistent in that, and that's probably what led to his defeat, I assume. Not that it probably remedied much for the common working person, but I didn't hear any of that. I just hear this personalist kind of discourse that is so frustrating in common political.
Well, Paul, let's go into that
Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, Paul, let's go into that a little further. Thank you for the call and bringing that up. What was at stake? I mean, what were the big issues that that the opposing sides were arguing in Congress and in the nation in Joe Cannon's time? And, you know, what was Joe Cannon trying to keep from happening?
I think that's a question for Matt.
Matt?
Yeah, but he was trying to block the progressive agenda. Reforms were on the one side, the reformers were looking to have an increased role for the federal government in terms of mediating labor disputes, things like the Pure Food and Drug Act, railroad management and rates, and you know, some of that was accomplished early in TR's term, that first term, the Hepburn Act, which controls rail rates. But Cannon increasingly begins to block that in that second term. Conservation's part of it. He's not a great reformer when it comes to tariff reform. There is a tariff that's passed in 1909, the Payne-Aldrich tariff, but it keeps rates still fairly high and protectionist and pro-business. And so he is on the side of big business, whereas TR is, he has a more progressive, moderate view.
Did Joe Cannon, as a stand-patter, to use his words, have a vision of his own? Was there a way that he would paint what he saw that he wanted for the country?
I think in a line it would be minimal government, minimal legislating. That certainly is his legacy. You look at him as a legislator. He did not pass a lot of bills. I think he may have passed a postal rate bill in the 1870s. He did get appropriations at key points. He helped McKinley get the bill through Congress that funded the Spanish-American War. There was an interesting, at the end of his speakership, an interesting article in one of the progressive magazines, Collier's, that identified him, I'm trying to recall the quote, on the political railroad, when it came to legislation, Uncle Joe was not the engineer, he was the brakeman. And he certainly had a very limited view of what the government could do in terms of getting involved in health, in occupational safety, in inspections, and very much a product of the 19th century, and a different view from TR and also Taft and certainly Wilson.
I'm wondering then, and first of all, I want to get in a quick question from an email that came in. There is a Cannon House office building in Washington, D.C. today.
That's right.
I understand it wasn't named until the 1960s, but did Joe Cannon have anything to do with getting that building built?
The building actually opened in 1908 during his speakership.
He actually allowed money for it.
Here's a guy who came into Congress in the 19th century, and a member's desk was their office, the desk on the floor. And so when this building, and I'm speaking to you from the Cannon building now, opened up, in 1908, it was revolutionary for Congress. Every member had an office. All of a sudden, there were congressional staff for rank and file members for the first time. So it had a big impact on the growth of Capitol Hill.
In regards to the Stand Pattism, that's correct. He pretty much was, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But another interesting editorialist described Cannon, I like the brakeman metaphor, but one editorialist noted that if Joe had been appointed to God's Committee on Creation, Joe would have voted for chaos, keeping the same.
And do you think, just to close out the interview, because I think you had been noting to me, Tim, that Joseph Cannon, people don't remember much about him, even in Danville.
That's correct.
Is it because simply of the nature of his political stance, and also because he ended up being essentially toppled by the new forces of progressive politics that came in the early 20th century. That's why he is not remembered so much today, even though he was so powerful?
No, I don't think so. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that in the mid-century, they tore down his house. And so the symbol available for him
in Danville
was gone.
They built a Piggly Wiggly there, I understand.
Yes, a Piggly Wiggly.
What's there today?
An empty building. It used to be a car dealership. But there's a school named after him, the Joe Cannon School in East Danville, which is appropriate, by the way, because back at that time, a federal presence in a community was extraordinarily low. Usually it was the post office. And Joe managed to get the old soldiers' home in East Danville, which is now the VA.
Well, we'll have to end the show there. We've been talking about Danville Congressman and House Speaker Joseph Cannon with local historian Tim Smith, who's working on a Cannon biography, and Matt Wasniewski, historian for the House of Representatives. Thanks to both of you for coming on Focus.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us on.
This is Focus on WYLL.